It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The information our state board seems to want to give our third and fourth graders is too graphic to even be shown on the nightly news. And why, my friends? Why are we robbing our children of their youth?
The new health and sex education framework tells teachers that students as young as kindergarten can identify as transgender and offers tips on how to talk about different identities. While some parents support the change, others strongly disagree, calling the guidelines inappropriate for classroom discussion.
I feel like that's something that should be talked about with me at home and not in a classroom.
Many protesters argued that a handful of the proposed books were too graphic, using close-up illustrations of children's and adults' private areas that would be shown to kids starting in third grade. Other books included topics such as gender fluidity, body changes, and guidelines to sexuality. In light of the pushback, the Board of Education decided to remove 5 of the proposed books and to remove the topic of masturbation from the framework. However, other books covering topics such as reproduction and LGBTQ relationships will remain a part of the framework. Moms like Amanda Patrick of Bakersfield say if local public school districts adopt the framework, it may be overstepping their boundaries.
We don't teach that our students can choose whatever religion they want to be. Why should we let kindergartners think that they can choose whatever gender they want to be?
According to the board, the framework is not meant to teach kids how to become trans or gay, but to provide teachers with language, tools, and resources that will help them navigate conversations that come up. For LGBTQ community members like Andrew Carl, they feel it is an inclusive approach.
So I like that it's including everybody in the sex talk, but I think kindergarten is way too young.
Each district in Kern County will now have to decide whether or not to implement the new framework. Parents can opt their student out of the specific lesson plans they don't agree with, and school districts are required to notify parents before these lessons take place.
I would definitely opt her out at this age. Junior high and high school, that's different, but she's only in second grade.
All right, so if that shocks your conscience, could I just say that what's happening in California, by the way, that was KERO in Bakersfield, if that shocks your conscience, let me just say this is not new. The public schools in the United States have been undergoing an assault and propaganda that should have shocked the nation a long time ago. But we're going to update you on it today. No one knows more about that and the progression of it than my next guest. Lori Higgins is the Illinois Family Institute cultural affairs writer. Prior to that, she was a full-time employee of Deerfield High School. That's one of the affluent areas of the northwest suburbs of Chicago, and that's how I met Lori. She was working in the writing section, and because of her strong stand at that school, as she watched things deteriorate in horrible ways, even then, she took a bold stand, and so later really had to leave the school because it became unbearable. So Lori now is at Illinois Family Institute, which is an affiliate of the American Family Association, and I'm always happy when she joins us. Good morning, Lori.
Hi, Sandy. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, say a word to, is this happening in California, that report we just heard in great detail. I'm sure we didn't even hear all of the gory details about it. Would you say now that that's typical of American public schools?
Oh, it's typical of American public schools, and one of the problems is a lot of parents don't know that it's going on. This made the press. But, I've been gone from Deerfield High School now for 11 years. When I was there, they were already pushing this in sex ed, which is sophomore year in high school. Now we've moved much younger. But, for example, here in the Chicago Public School Districts, they started teaching about homosexuality in kindergarten several years ago. So the problem is either that people are not paying attention or that they are, and they're dismissing it as unimportant. They dismiss, well, that's just this little event, that's just this little teaching in this one course. But the way cultural change happens isn't through huge dramatic events in an instant. It happens through the accretion of little things that we ignore, and then they build, and then they build, and they build. And the third reason is that conservatives are largely cowardly. So they don't want to address anything that, if they do, they might be labeled a hater. Even though we are told in Scripture, for those of us who are Christians, we're going to be hated. And so we've let this slide, and now we have this trans juggernaut taking place, and so we're addressing it in kindergarten. The California school district that you were referring to recommended as one of the age-appropriate picture books to read to children, My Princess Boy, which people can go online and actually see the entire book read by someone to see, and they can figure out for themselves if they think that's age-appropriate for kindergartners.
Lori, just one detail before we move to the broader issue. I recall after I left Illinois, Barack Obama was a senator there, as you well remember, and he was very active in laying the groundwork and pushing through some radical sex ed in the schools there. Do you remember the details of that?
Well, I do remember his mandates, which not only went to the Department of Education, but to every department, saying that when the word sex appears, and we're going to see this again in the Equality Act, but where the word sex appears, for instance, in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972, that word should be interpreted as inclusive of gender identity, which is just this made-up concept that the left has invented in order to normalize biological sex rejection. So he sent those out to every department, and they were, in effect, mandates. Fortunately, President Trump has rescinded those. But I want to make one. You mentioned that I took a strong stance at Deerfield High School. I mean, it's sad that it's strong, but the stance that I took actually was, if the school is going to present resources that affirm, espouse, embody leftist ideas about sexuality, they had a pedagogical obligation to include dissenting resources, because that's what education does, is it fosters critical thinking, and it does it by introducing kids to diverse resources. That was the strong stance I took that got people to hate me.
Yeah, and it worked really well, Lori. So you got them to hate you.
It did. And I want to, that's another point. When I was there in the writing center full-time, but I was a member of the English department, people who had been my friends, after I started saying, if you're going to teach, for example, Angels in America, a really obscene play that intended to normalize homosexuality and transgender ideology, if you're going to present that, you have to present dissenting resources. They not only wouldn't speak to me, some of them wouldn't sit in the same room with me, even though they acknowledged that I always treated them graciously.
Yes, and let me just add, Lori, because I remember this well, they ended up putting you in an office in the basement all by yourself. It was just amazing,
right?
An amazing experience, which laid the groundwork for your great writing on these issues. And so let's move now to a really current update on the National Education Association. You and I have discussed this, of course, before, and I always have to say in these conversations, because I've been around the block for a long time here, that I remember in the 1980s, when the National Education Association began to slip into the advocacy of homosexuality at the time. And they created, at the time, a DVR called It's Elementary. I watched the whole thing. It was shocking because they were training teachers how to get around parents, how to mainstream this, how to deceive. And then, of course, they were being very blatant, but not quite as blatant as they're being now. We found out years later that the head of the Education Association then was a gay man who was not out. And so it became kind of the focus of the NEA, National Education Association, early on, and they became more and more aggressive. But now I think they've reached all-time heights or lows, depending on your perspective. You just wrote an article on what they have just done at their annual meeting, I think in July. And so just tell us about what's going on there now, Lori.
Yeah, it was just last weekend, actually, in Houston. And so this was at their representative assembly, which is somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 members. That's not the entire NEA. And they passed, well, they had 160 business items, some of which now are referred to committee for study. But these are some of the new business items that passed the NEA. So some people, I think it's made the press, that they affirmed a fundamental right to abortion and opposes all attacks on the right to choose. They've also taken a position to oppose, to call the Trump administration to end detention of illegal immigrants, including an end to ICE raids. They call for the government to accept responsibility for the destabilization of Central America that's responsible for the increase of migrants at our border. They're pushing for reparations. They are making Equality Act a top legislative priority. They want to incorporate the concept of white fragility into NEA trainings, development, literature, etc. And for those who haven't heard the term, I call it a racist leftist term, which mocks, criticizes, and silences white people who disagree with the assumptions of what some people call critical race theory or teaching for social justice. Here's one of the, we were talking about homosexuality, here's one of the troubling ones. They want to create model legislative language that state affiliates can use to lobby for a K through 12 cross-content curriculum that is LGBTQ inclusive. In other words, it's not enough that we teach about homosexuality and transgenderism in through social and emotional learning, anti-bullying resources, and health class. They want it in all content areas, which will make it impossible for parents to opt their child out, which is, of course, the goal. And so, and they want to include, and they want to increase the Gay-Straight Alliance clubs in schools and the participation of their advisors. It's a whole a range of problematic. They want to promote Black Lives Matter Week of Action in pre-K through 12 schools. So there's, oh, they have a position on climate change also. In other words, it's every radical position of the Democratic Party is now what the NEA has formally adopted as business items.
You know, what's interesting here, we should say, Lori, that the National Education Association, at least it was and probably still is, the very largest, most well-funded lobbying entity in Washington. At least it was. My human rights campaign may have eclipsed them by now, I don't know. But it was the professional organization that teachers pretty much had to belong to, or there was a lot of ostracism and trouble, because then you didn't get protections for mistreatment in the workplace if you didn't agree to join and pay dues. And then the dues were spent on helping elect radical candidates. So it was like it's not a circular firing squad, but it's a circular, you know, helping squad, I guess. I just wanted people to understand exactly who they are. Now, I think I read in your piece that they have changed their rules so that they can be funded from other sources. I think you wrote about that,
yes,
didn't you?
I did. Yeah. I did. That was the membership change. Oh, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think people will gloss over it. It's kind of boring to read about it, but and it required 2/3 of the delegates to amend their constitution. They now allow non-educators to become members, which allows them one thing, to donate to the NEA's Political Action Committee. So they can't vote, they can't nominate on these like business items, they can't nominate candidates for office or hold governance positions. All they can do is donate money to the Political Action Committee. So what that does is strengthen the stranglehold that progressives, and I'm using that word loosely, have in the NEA. So, for instance, if you could...
Quickly, Lori.
Okay, if you could join and have an effect, then there would be a reason for conservatives to join. Now there's no reason, because all you can do is donate to their political action.
Okay, well, this is one of three articles we're going to post today of Lori's. This is on the NEA. You'll want to watch it. You'll want to see it. Because we didn't get to everything, and you need to be able to read it and share. All right, my guest is Lori Higgins from the Illinois Family Institute. Next, we're going to talk about the practical results of your kids being propagandized in this way. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
There were three different options presented. The third included the option for family separation. This initiative would pursue prosecution of all amenable adults, including those presenting with a family unit. Mr. Homan, your name is on this. Is this correct?
Yes, I signed that memo.
So you are the author of the family separation policy?
I am not the author of this memo.
You're not the author, but you signed the memo.
Yes, a zero tolerance memo.
So you provided the official recommendation to Secretary Nielsen on family, for the United States to pursue family separation.
I gave Secretary Nielsen numerous recommendations on how to secure the border and save lives.
But it says here that you gave her numerous options, but the recommendation was option three, family separation.
What I'm saying, this is not the only paper where we've given the Secretary numerous options to secure the border and save lives.
And so the recommendation, of the many that you recommended family separation.
I recommended zero tolerance.
Which includes family separation.
The same as it is with every U.S. citizen parent gets arrested when they're with a child.
Zero tolerance was interpreted as the policy that separated children from their
If parents. I get arrested for DUI and I have a young child in a car, I'm going to be separated. When I was a police officer in New York and I arrested a father for domestic violence, I separated that
Mr.
father
Holman,
from his
family. With all due respect, legal asylees are not charged with any crime.
When you're in the country illegally, it's violation 8 United States Code 1325.
Seeking asylum is legal.
If you want to seek asylum, you go through the port of entry, do it the legal way. The Attorney General of the United States has made that clear.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the memo is submitted to the record for review.
All right. That was the voice, of course, of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman from New York, and the acting ICE director, former Tom Homan, under Barack Obama. By the way, you've seen Tom a lot on television. You've heard him on this show. And so that interaction to me demonstrates two things. I've said before that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the other women who we're talking about now, most of them except Ilhan Omar, have been raised in the American school system. Something's not right here. And all of our children who are rebelling and the mobs we see in Antifa, something's not right here. And so Lori Higgins is my guest this morning from the Illinois Family Institute. Lori, you just wrote an article about this whole business of the teaching of social justice warriors in public school. Explain that to us and explain to us why we're seeing what we're seeing in our streets and in the halls of Congress.
Yes. Well, I want to point out one other clip that you didn't play, maybe you're going to, about Jesus Garcia, U.S. Representative Jesus Garcia, in the same hearing, accused Tom Homan of not caring about migrant children because they aren't white. So, and everyone should watch his response. It's really
well,
remarkable.
Hang on a second. You know what? We've got it. We'll play it. Let's just listen right now.
Mr. Homan, do you understand that the consequences of separation of many children will be lifelong trauma and carried across generations? Have we not learned from the internment of Japanese Americans? Mr. Homan, I'm a father. Do you have children? How can you possibly allow this to happen under your watch? Do you not care? Is it because these children don't look like children that are around you? I don't get it. Have you ever held a deceased child in your arms?
First of all, your comments are disgusting. I've served my
country for 34 years. I find your comments
disgusting
out of control. As well.
I've served my country for 34 years. And yes, I held a five-year-old boy in my arms and backed that tractor trailer. I knelt down beside him and said a prayer for him because I knew what his last 30 minutes of his life were like. And I had a five-year-old son at the time. What I've been trying to do my 34 years serving my nation is to save lives. So for you to sit there and insult my integrity and my love for my country and for children, that's why this whole thing needs to be fixed. And you're the member of Congress.
We agree on that.
Fix it.
We agree on that. But I disagree. But I also disagree with your characterization of immigrants as prone to criminality.
People for three decades on this.
Gentlemen, time has expired. It's my time now.
Mr. Chairman.
It's my time. Now, Mr. Homan, do you have something to say?
No one in this room has seen what I've seen in my 34-year career.
Very well.
No one has experienced what I've experienced. I've saw many dead bodies coming across this border. And you want to talk about the memo? This memo is one option to stop death. not just about enforcing the law, stop death. If you want to legalize illegal immigration, good luck with that, because it's a lot worse than that border. If you say, well, okay, from now on, there will be no consequence, no deterrence. It's not illegal to come to this country illegally. More families will come. 31% women would be raped. More children would die. We're a nation of laws. If you don't like it, sir, change it. You're the legislator. I'm the executive branch, and I've served my country honorably for 34 years. And I will not sit here and have anybody say that I don't care about children because you're not the same color as my children.
That was Congressman Jesus Garcia grilling former acting ICE director Tom Homan. And so, Lori, your observations about that interaction.
Well, my observations are that this comes out of what's being taught in public schools and has been for a long time. When Antifa and Black Lives Matter appeared on the horizon, people were saying, conservatives were saying, oh my gosh, this is a result of what they've learned in college. It does not start in college. I left, as I said earlier, I left Deerfield High School 11 years ago. This stuff was being taught at Deerfield High School then. I had a student once, and I'm telling this anecdote because it's representative, not because it's an isolated incident, but I worked with a student on her paper, and she came out of what was called American Studies. That's integrated social studies in English. And when I finished reading her paper, I said, wow, you have kind of a negative view of America. And she said, oh, yeah, by the time first semester in this class ended, I hated America and hated being an American. And that's because of the infusion of this critical social theory, critical race theory, critical teaching for social justice, which divides America into the groups that are supposedly oppressors and the ones who are oppressed. Of course, if you're white, male, and heterosexual, you are at the top of the oppression food chain. And it teaches people that their lot in life cannot improve unless those who are in the oppressor class have a sufficient degree of self-flagellation, acknowledging endlessly their part. And the parts that we play, it's just a matter of identity politics. You can feel no superiority. You can treat no one any differently, but the mere fact of being white or male or heterosexual means you are an oppressor, and that's what has come now to roost in Congress in people like AOC.
Yes, and on the streets in Antifa, and, you know, really in the discourse of journalists on television. It's really
right.
It's just stunning. It really is. And by the way, this article that Lori has just written about this, we'll also put it on our Facebook page because I really think you should be reading it. It's Strange Bedfellows, Illegal Immigrants and American Hating Social Justice Warriors. The other way we're seeing it affect our nation in profound ways is elections, Lori. We've got a 2020 presidential election coming up. We've got this incredible hatred of Donald Trump for his so-called racism. He's all of the things you just said. He's a white male. And he fits perfectly to be the object of this social warrior justice. But we also have just confused thinking. And when I think of that, I think an illustration is Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who's running. I'm sure you're very familiar with him since he's right next door to Chicago. But Pete has introduced another form of confusion. Let's just listen to what he has to say, and then I'd love your comments on it. Here it is.
It's hard to face the truth that there were times in my life when if you had shown me exactly what it was inside me that made me gay, I would have cut it out with a knife. When I came out in 2015, it was for the simple reason that I was finally ready. I had been wrestling with my sexuality for years. And if I had not deployed to Afghanistan, I might never have found the courage to come out. But there's something that happens to you when you write a letter and put it in an envelope and write just in case on the outside and leave it where your family can find it if they have to. It forces you to realize that you only get one life. That you only get to be one person. My marriage to Chasten has made me a better man. And yes, Mr. Vice President, it has moved me closer to God. The struggle is not over when transgender troops, ready to put their lives on the line for this country, have their careers threatened with ruin one tweet at a time by a commander-in-chief who himself pretended to be disabled in order to get out of serving when it was his turn. So, next time a reporter asked me if America is ready for a gay president, I'm going to tell the truth. I'm going to give them the only answer that I can think of that's honest, and it's this. I trust my fellow Americans. But at the end of the day, there is exactly one way to find out for sure.
All right. So, Lori, he's your neighbor. And, of course, we heard what he just claimed. I'd love your thoughts about that.
Well, I mean, my concern about this, of course, was his election would go even further in terms of compelling Americans to view homosexuality as not a moral issue. His statement, he's closer to God, is simply deceit. You can't be closer to God by affirming something which God abhors. And what God abhors is homosexual activity. It's not about people. This is about activity, and these are about moral propositions. When he talks about the acceptance people should feel toward their own feelings, their own homoerotic attraction, I would ask him, would he apply that principle consistently to every subjective internal desire that humans have? And that's what is, when the left continually hurls the epithet hater at Christians particularly, the distinction they're failing to make is a distinction between disapproval of volitional activity and disapproval or hatred of persons. Most people in America, including most Christians, can deeply love and enjoy the company and admire the good traits of people who affirm homosexuality while still believing that homosexual activity is wrong. Most of us do it every day. And I think the left, they project their hatred of people whose beliefs are different onto conservatives. But most conservative Christians love people who believe differently than they do, and we do it every day.
But, of course, Pete has a big megaphone. He has, anyway. I think he's receded a little bit, but the deception is just, it's a continuing propaganda machine, but this one coming at Americans, and I think there are people are willing to receive it because they've been propagandized in public schools. I want to move to another story. This is one that's been big in the news. I know you're familiar with it. It has to do with the U.S. soccer team. Let's listen to this one.
You guys are the first openly gay couple to be on the cover of the Body Issue. What does that mean to you?
Neither of us really want to just do things and be like, we're the gay couple. I'm more of like the out the out there gay one. But it's like it to have this really unique vehicle to actually do that and to, you know, celebrate who we are in our sport, but also the fact that, you know, we'll be the first gay couple is pretty special. I mean, it's pretty amazing, actually, to think about, especially in the times we're in.
Having a gay couple on there, hopefully it just becomes the norm. You know, you want it to not be an issue. You know, I think, and that's for us to be on it is the first step in that direction.
Megan Rapinoe and her partner Sue Bird, the basketball player, and of course we don't need to say too much. I've certainly talked enough about Megan Rapinoe in the last few days, but Lori, I'd be curious to know about what you think about all of that.
Well, I want to say that I feel very sorry for some of the women on the soccer team who had to contend with everything that this young woman has said and done since they won the World Cup. We still are not talking about, and we never have really talked about, the foundational assumptions that undergird the debate and the controversy about homosexuality, and that's what's lost. The left has learned that strategically it works just to call people names, and then you won't have to say, what is homosexuality? So, and I don't mean, I'm not talking here about what causes it, which is another really important discussion to have, because even leftist psychotherapists acknowledge that sexual molestation can result in either, they call it sexual orientation confusion or homoerotic attraction. I actually posted an article this week from Psychology Today on that issue from not a conservative therapist. So that is an important issue. But what I'm talking about is what constitutes homosexuality? Is it like race? In what ways is homosexuality per se analogous to race? Zero. But they don't want to have that discussion because comparing it to race has worked for them strategically. So that's the discussion that conservatives should continue to push. Well, what is homosexuality? Because all it is subjective erotic internal feelings and erotic attraction. And so therefore, and now we'll see this, well, I think if we're going to talk about the APA, we'll see that because they're trying to say that polyamory is now a sexual orientation.
Yes, and we're going to get to that in just a second. Let me, in the just remaining couple of minutes of this segment, I did want to point to something encouraging, Lori, and that's that Harris poll, which is a pro-gay poll, really, that showed just a few days ago that in 2016, 63% of millennials considered themselves allies of the LGBT movement. And we know why, because we've just talked about it. But the number plunged to 45% last year. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it's really interesting, and it's a very hopeful, and I want to be clear, I am not hoping that people will become hateful toward homosexuals. I'm hoping that people will understand the issue and understand that you can love people and still disapprove of homosexual activity. It is hopeful, and I think because the left has pushed too hard on this issue.
Yeah, that's kind of what I think, too. And I think it's truth is finally having its way on that. That would be a whole show, and I wish we had more time to flesh that out, maybe in the next segment. But when we come back, there's another barn burner story, and it's coming out of the American Psychological Association. And I have an interesting story about that that Lori does not know, so I'm going to share that with her on the other side of the break, so stay tuned. Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
In the larger battle over gay rights, some argued that gay men and lesbians could change. Advocates of so-called conversion therapy cited the work of Dr. Robert Spitzer, one of the giants of American psychiatry, who conducted a study of 200 ex-gay men and published his conclusions 9 years ago. From the start, critics attacked Dr. Spitzer's work and his conclusions. Now 80 years old and suffering from Parkinson's disease, Dr. Spitzer concluded earlier this year that they were right. He's drafted a letter recanting his study and issued an apology.
All right, so that's NPR, and that was 2012. And the reason I'm playing that for you, Dr. Robert Spitzer was very much a central figure in the whole morphing between the listing of homosexuality as a mental disorder in what was called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders for the APA. Dr. Spitzer was the chairman of the American Psychiatric Association's task force, which oversaw the DSM. And in 1980, when they released it, now I may have the year not quite right here, the gay activists stormed the floor of the meeting of the APA that year and so intimidated the psychiatrists there who were, you know, not quite as far along in embracing them as they are now. And so basically managed. There's a whole account of this on NPR. Actually, it's fascinating. They managed to intimidate the psychiatrists there to actually change and alter their Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders and remove homosexuality from that. And Dr. Spitzer embraced that. And then in 2003, I think it was, Dr. Spitzer did a study of, he came across a group of ex-gay men, I think it was Exodus International, got acquainted with them, and he proceeded then to do a study of whether men could actually come out of the lifestyle, and he published it in 2003. The reason I know as much about this as I know is I interviewed Dr. Spitzer in 2003 or 2004 after this had just come out. I'll never forget that. He was an atheist Jew, but a very honest man. But you heard in NPR about how my conversation with him was the vitriol that was aimed at him for publishing this paper, and how disconcerting it was to him. Because his peers were turning against him. Lori, I guess you can relate to that. But that's the kind of the story of Dr. Spitzer. But you now have written about a recent development in the APA, and so that's what I'd look to you to tell us about right now.
Well, yes. I mean, you've pointed out how little credibility the APA should have after that was 1973 change in the DSM, which, by the way, on NPR, people can read or listen to. It's called 81 Words They Should Look For. Just Google that, and it's really fascinating. But now the APA, which I did not know, had a section called Division 44, which is the Society for the Psychology of Sexual Orientation and Gender Diversity. This began in 1985 by homosexuals within the APA, but they now have within there a task force on consensual non-monogamy, which for those who've been reading the press in the past few years is another term for polyamory, which is the romantic and sexual attraction and involvement with multiple people at the same time. And so the whole point of this task force is to normalize polyamory. They want to remove the stigma attached to it. And so stigma is, I would say, it's a negative term just to refer to disapproval. So anytime a culture disapproves of something, we would never say, oh gosh, we got to remove the stigma attached to pedophilia or hebephilia. That's, you know, different ages of children. They've divided now pedophilia into. And so they want to remove the stigma in order that it will be approved of by the culture. And so they've created this task force, which if you go to my article online, I took the whole task force's advisory board and did a very brief one or two section sentence description of each of the characters on this. And they're all people who affirm sexual perversion in one way or another. They actually describe the task force as they want to promote awareness and inclusivity about, and this is their description, people who practice polyamory, open relationships, swinging, and relationship anarchy. That's their term. And they view polyamory as a sexual orientation. What's important about that is conservatives have long been warning other conservatives about the dangers of including the term sexual orientation in anti-discrimination policies and laws, because since sexual orientation really refers to the direction in which your sexual interests are impelled, that we knew that it would eventually come to include other things. Polyamory is one. All the paraphilias, those are all the forms of sexual deviance humans can experience, and that's exactly what's happened. And I want to point out one person in particular. His name is Richard Sprott, if you go to my article online. He recently presented at a bondage discipline sadomasochism convention in Cleveland a workshop called SCAT, Beyond Brown. Well, SCAT refers to feces play. So this is the person that is one of the people who is on the task force to normalize polyamory.
I don't know what to say, except I'm sure I'll think of something. It's just that, you know, Lori, when I was a president of CWA in the early 2000s, I remember warning people that polyamory was coming next. These other things I never even dreamed about, you know. But polyamory, because the sexual anarchists then were telling us, they were pushing for that even then, and pedophilia too.
Right.
And so, may correct me if I'm wrong, you are saying that the American Psychological Association is actually embracing and pushing and has formed a task force to mainstream and normalize and bring under the protection of sexual orientation laws these kinds of behavior.
Right, exactly. And multiple people on the advisory council who are professors and but some of them are just BDSM activists, multiple people affirm other forms of sexual deviance. And these are the people. So I ask the question, in what universe is feces play considered psychologically healthy? And these are the people who have decided that polyamory is psychologically healthy and good for society. One thing that's important is the whole marriage debate. When we were having the marriage debate before Obergefell, I was on a radio program with the ACL spokesperson in Chicago, and he kept saying, marriage is the union of any two people who love each other. And I repeatedly asked him, why two people? Of course, conservatives know why marriage is the union of two people, because there are two sexes. But now with the trans ideology, you know, that proposition is out the window. And so the decision in Obergefell to separate marriage from both biological sex and from reproductive potential made it inevitable that we would move toward an affirmation of plural unions, including, obviously, polyamory. Because if marriage has no connection to sex and no connection to reproductive potential, there's no reason to limit it to two people. There's no rational, coherent reason. So it's not just that polyamory became, the acceptance of it became possible, it made it inevitable.
So people are hearing this story about the APA, and they're saying, you know, oh, who cares what a group of doctors decide, and that's not us, and that's not how we feel, and that's not how Americans feel. What possible effect can the decision of the APA to embrace and promote this, what will it have on the American culture?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of really important things about that. As we have increasingly moved away from religion, particularly Christianity, as a source and arbiter of morality and reality, and as the trans ideology has moved away from even hard science, the woefully unstable social sciences have assumed some sort of exalted position as the arbiter of truth, reality, and morality in American culture, and the APA is hugely influential. And so their ideas are going to percolate through the culture and change the culture. And I also want to say, this is what conservatives do all the time. We say, oh my gosh, look at that weird thing on the fringe. We don't have to pay attention to that because it's on the fringe. And they pay no attention, and the fringes move into the center, and our center will not hold.
So, Lori, I know that in your article about the National Education Association, which we talked about earlier in the show, you have a suggestion about a solution there, and I want to talk about that, but let's just talk about solutions. I know that you and I think about it, and it's so overwhelming that it's hard to imagine that we could do anything to orchestrate a stop to this. I have some thoughts about it, but I want to know what you think.
Well, here are the two, I would say, people need to speak out, so, but my two main recommendations for Christians. One, get a spine. We have been promised that we're going to be persecuted for our faith. We're supposed to take up our cross daily. We're supposed to consider it joy when we encounter trials for Christ in his kingdom. And we do, I'm talking in broad generalities, there's people like you who do honor all those expectations and welcome that kind of persecution. But for the most part, Christians in America have retreated, intentionally fled from even the most minor persecution, like having a friend mad at them. We have to recover a theology of persecution and welcome that. And that's why church leaders have to teach that, but church leaders are largely cowardly. So, and the other thing is, we must pull our children out of public schools. We need to still be engaged as Christians. It's a matter of stewardship. Our money is being used to teach evil ideas to children, but we need to pull our own children out. But many parents, there's one wage earner in the family, or there are two people, and they're working just to make ends meet. They can't afford to send their kids to Christian private schools, and they can't homeschool. Churches must use money, make it available as a fund for their church members to send their kids to private schools, and or create Christian private schools that are affordable. This should be a mission field right now. We can't have our kids taught by people who don't recognize that men and women are different.
Yeah. You also talk about retirees, Lori. You have some you have some strong words about that. So say a word about what retirees could actually and should actually be doing.
Yes. Retirees should not retire from their job if they're in good health and then just golf. They need to be working for the kingdom. And this is such a fantastic resource. I know lots of retirees who are healthy and they have huge kinds of skills available, organizational skills, knowledge, wisdom. They're mature in their faith. They should be working to help create schools, to teach in schools, to volunteer their time, to come up with, you know, plans, be creative. John Piper, I called it legendary admonition, wrote a piece, he had this little recommendation to retirees, and he gave an example saying, you know, do you want that to be what your last record is when you stand before the Lord after you die, to say, wow, I spent a lot of time on my boat and collecting shells, And I would say I want to encourage retirees to reach out and figure out what they can do, and churches need to ask them to do that. There's also a problem with loneliness among our retirees, so it would solve two problems at once, or multiple problems.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely spot on. You know, I think to take this to the down to the part where, you know me, I believe in acting and working and doing, but we also recognize the hand of God, and I think we talked about that survey or the poll earlier, the Harris poll, that showed that millennials, their support for the LGBT movement has really, I'd say, plunged. I think that's probably a pretty good word for it. When it moves from, 60% to down to 45%, something like that. And I think that truth, you know, has power. It isn't because we've gone on some campaign to do what you just said. We have failed to educate our kids.
Right.
And so I can't we can't lay that at our own feet. I think that that's just a matter of them experiencing working relationships and friendships with the LGBT crowd and having been the recipient of all that propaganda. So truth does have a power of its own. And yet we need to rise up and just continue to speak the truth boldly, as Lori Higgins of the Illinois Family Institute has just admonished us. Lori, thank you so much. We're going to put your article on the APA also on our Facebook page so that people can read it. And I encourage people to read and share Lori's articles because they are always profound. Lori, thank you so much. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.